in this series. I went to a couple already in this series, and it's great to see people talking about everything from nanotechnology to economics. So I'm going to be talking about higher dimensional algebra, which is the algebra that you use to describe sticking together higher dimensional shapes, higher dimensional meaning say two or more. And I'm going to argue that it's a good language for describing quantum space-time. No one really knows what quantum space-time is. We'd like to have a quantum mechanical theory of space-time. We have some theories, but we don't really know what's the right one. However, one interesting thing, I think, is that all the attempts that I know of to really seriously go after a theory of quantum space-time wind up using ideas from higher categories. And so that's what I'd like to talk about today. And I'd like to say some things that hopefully are interesting to quantum information people, loop quantum gravity people, and also string theorists, because they're all really, they all really fit together in a certain way in this story. So the big idea is that once upon a time, mathematics was all about sets. So a set looks sort of like that thing up there. Let's see if my pointer works. So it's a bag of dots. It's an amazing fact that in their relentless drive for reductionism, reducing everything to the simplest possible ideas, the logicians were able to found all the mathematics we know and love on this simple concept of a bag of dots, where what are those dots? Well, in set theory, those are also bags of dots themselves. And it's sort of amazing that you can talk about pi, for example, the number pi, and in set theory, pi is just a set, so it's in fact just one of those things. But it's not necessarily the clearest way to think about things, for after all, we don't normally think of pi as being a bag of dots. And so there's the possibility that even though set theory is a perfectly successful foundation for mathematics, that a sort of enhanced foundation of mathematics could lead to new insights, sort of like how a fancier operating system can sit on top of a more primitive basic operating system. And in 1945, the mathematicians Eilenberg and MacLane introduced what I think of as like the version 2.0 or 1.0, I guess, called category theory, where in addition to having dots, you have arrows as well. I happen to have found one on the floor just earlier. So the idea is that besides dots, which are like a simple metaphor for a thing, in category theory they're called objects, we also introduce as an equal, at an equal footing, an equal primitive, the idea of a morphism, which is the technical term for one of these arrows. And what they stand for is processes. So in other words, instead of trying to sort of start with the static world of bunches of dots, and then go through a complicated definition of a function as being a certain set of ordered pairs and all that jazz, to get some notion of process built into mathematics, we put process in right from the start. Now that's led to a huge amount of work. There's a wonderful bunch of work that's been done on category theory since then, which really provides a whole elaborate vocabulary for discussing different aspects of categories, different examples of categories. But unfortunately, I don't have time to talk about that. And so I will dive right in, to the next level, which was in the 60s when everything was getting radical. Benabou introduced two categories, where in addition to having dots and arrows, you have arrows between arrows called two morphisms, which you can think of as processes that go from one process to another process. Yes?
What is a process?
A process is when something happens. A process is a very vague concept, which I'm not attempting to formalize. The formal concept is that of two category, and I'm going to give you the precise definition of that a little bit later, and then you'll get to run around looking to see if you can find examples of them where you take something that you think of as a process and map it into this mathematical vocabulary. I'm trying to use process in a deliberately incredibly vague way, which I refuse to define it.
But a process is necessarily about the relationship between dots in the bag?
A process is a thing that goes from one dot to another. That's all I can say. I'll define a category, and then you'll learn a little bit more, but not much more. So it's meant to be an incredibly general concept. And so the to get it to do something good for you, you have to work a bit. In other words, find specific examples, prove lots of theorems, and so on. I will give a bunch of examples from physics. So,
is there a strong two category as well?
Yeah, so now weak sounds sort of bad, but actually weak is good. It's just unfortunate terminology. In fact, Benjamin called them bi-categories. For our purposes, the only reason for these distinctions is that some other people may see these slides on the web and think that I've forgotten the difference between various different kinds of two categories. But for our purposes, it's not all that important. The idea is that there are such things as strict two categories, where these arrows in here satisfy a whole bunch of laws, like the associative law on the nodes as equations. Whereas in a weak two category, or in general a weak n category, all the laws hold only up to isomorphism in a suitable way. And that's sort of the right notion, in fact. But we're getting sort of way ahead of ourselves.
So you're talking about self-interactions and self-processes?
The source and target of one of those arrows can be the same. It can start and end up at the same place. Yeah, so I gave you some examples of how that gives. Right. So, for example, if I turn an eraser 360 degrees around, that's a process that starts and ends at the same point. So that would be that type of thing. And so group theory is all about those arrows that go and start and end at the same place. It turned out to be incredibly hard, harder than people expected, to go from the concept of two categories to the concept of three category. So even though I'm sure as soon as people read about two categories, they started thinking about three categories, the full notion of it was only managed to be successfully introduced in 1995 by Gordon Power and Ross Street, the Australian mathematician who's sort of the king of n category theory. And since then, people have come up with a number of different approaches to defining weak n categories in general, and that's one of my main subjects of interest, because it turns out that this theory, where you allow processes between processes between processes to your heart's content, really unifies lots of different branches of mathematics in very interesting ways. But I'm not going to talk about that. I'm going to talk about what this has to do with physics. So how, for starters, do plain old-fashioned categories impact physics? Well, as I said, a category is an incredibly general notion, so there would be lots of answers to this question. It would be sort of like saying, how does set theory impact physics? It sort of plays a basic role in many things, but nothing too much to say about it. But categories, because they're sort of more structured, there's more specific things you can say. And what I want to say to this audience here is that you learn a very important lesson by thinking about physics category theoretically. Namely, I claim that quantum theory will make more sense when we start seeing it as part of a theory of space-time. But the analogy that underlies this can only be seen when you use categories. So I have to try to convince you of this. So the rough idea is that all the weird, strange, counterintuitive, puzzling features of quantum theory have as a source the fact that the category of Hilbert spaces and linear operators between Hilbert spaces, called Hild, is a lot less like the familiar category of sets and functions between sets than it is like the category n-cob. N-cob, n-dimensional cobordisms, is the category where objects are n minus 1 manifolds and morphisms are n manifolds with boundary thought of as going from some n minus 1 manifold to another. Or in more physics-y lingo, the objects are different choices of what space could be and morphisms are different choices of space-time. So I'm claiming that quantum mechanics will seem counterintuitive if we think of Hilbert spaces as being a whole lot like sets. So we talk, for example, of a set of states, and that's, I think, part of the problem. It's not false, but I think it's misleading. It turns out that the right analogy is quite different. So the idea is this. In any category, we have a bunch of objects and a bunch of morphisms. I'll give the full definition of a category in a minute, but that's for sure. There's a category of sets, which is what set theory is really about, where the objects are all the sets in the world, and the morphisms are all functions between all the sets in the world. And that's sort of the category that started the whole ball rolling, sort of the basic category. That's the category that set theory was all about. In quantum theory, we think a lot about other categories, one of which is the category where the objects are Hilbert spaces. So those describe the states of a quantum system. And the morphisms are operators between Hilbert spaces, which I would like to think of as processes. So process, again, is a deliberately vague word, but here I specifically mean operator. But you know, this could include unitary operators, but also projection operators and other things. In general relativity, there's another category sort of lurking behind it. There's a lot more to it than this, but lurking behind it is this idea of a category where you have all these manifolds of a certain dimension that could represent space, and then cobordisms, one higher dimension going between them, that we think of as space-time. So I'm saying that in quantum gravity, what we'd like to do is unite quantum theory and general relativity, which means uniting the concept of state of a system, quantum system, and space. Because, of course, in quantum gravity, presumably, if there's any notion of space at all, it will have quantum states. There'll be different quantum possibilities for the geometry of space. And similarly, the idea of quantum process should somehow be connected to the concept of space-time. Now, let me get a little more specific. So any category has objects and morphisms. So I've already told you this, but I'll tell you again. So I'm going to focus on three different categories here. So the category of sets, where you have the objects are sets and the morphisms are functions. So every morphism starts at some place and ends at some place, meaning starts at some object and ends at some object. So that would be the source and target of the function in the case of sets. Hilbert spaces is another category where the objects are Hilbert spaces and the morphisms are linear operators. That seems a lot like the category of sets, because a Hilbert space is just a set with a whole bunch of structure, and an operator is just a function preserving that structure. But not all categories have the morphisms being functions, and indeed, n cob is one of these other type. The objects are n minus one dimensional manifolds, and the morphisms are cobordisms between those. So this is not in any sense a function from S to S time. It's just a space time or something like that. And so what I'm going to argue is that, in fact, Hilb can be better understood by thinking of it like this. So I'll get to that in a minute.
Can you define cobordism?
Yeah, so it's an n-dimensional manifold with boundary, such that the boundary is a disjoint union of two parts. And the first part is equipped with a diffeomorphism to S. And the second part is equipped with a diffeomorphism to S prime, where S and S prime are two given n minus one manifolds. So that's the precise definition. It's not quite the precise definition. The real precise definition is that it's an equivalence class of those things where we say that two of them are equivalent if they're diffeomorphic. Yeah, and that's not completely precise. But I could get it. You could squeeze it out of me if you want to, really. But we need those equivalence relations to make composition of cobordisms be associated. So every category has composition, an ability to compose morphisms. And composition is required to satisfy the associative law. And of course, it's also has to be that the composite starts at the right place and ends at the right place. So in set, this is just composition of functions. In Hilbert's, in Hill, this is just composition of operators, the usual thing. In n-cob, it's sticking together these cobordisms end to end, so gluing them along the intermediate space like this. And so that, of course, is how the world works. If we wait from some space-like slice to another, and then wait a while to the next one, we have this longer day. this longer interval of time, which is an early interval, which is this composite of morphisms. Every category has to have identity morphism. So for every object X, there's an identity morphism from it to itself. And it has to satisfy the properties that identities are supposed to satisfy. If you compose identities with other morphisms, you get those other morphisms. So in set, those are just the identity functions from any set to itself. And ditto for Hill, it's just the identity linear operator, which is of course this function. In NCOB, the identity morphisms are what you would call cylinders. In other words, the identity on S is just S cross an interval made into a cobordism from S to X. So topologically speaking, nothing is happening there during that process. Now, so that's it for categories. So we've seen these three examples, and you may say, well, what's the big deal? They're just these three examples. But the point is that there are properties that Hilde and NCOB have in common that make them very different from the category of sets, which is what I claim is why quantum mechanics seems weird, because we think of sets and functions as sort of normal in our mathematical and physical thought. And we can see this by noticing a fact, which is, well, first of all, this is a commonality. All these examples are what are called monoidal categories, i.e. categories that have a tensor product, and they also have a unit for the tensor product. So I'm using tensor product in a sort of generalized sense here. In the case of the category of sets, this so-called tensor product is just the Cartesian product of sets. And the unit for that is whatever your favorite one element is. Just pick your favorite one. So in other words, we have that any set cross the one element set is isomorphic to that set. So it acts as a unit on both sides. So in Hill, the tensor product is the tensor product for real. And the unit object is the complex number. So if you tensor Hilbert space with C, you get that Hilbert space back. In NCOB, the tensor product looks like this. Here I'm actually drawing you a picture of the tensor product, not of the objects, but of the morphisms. In every case, in fact, you can tensor not only the objects, for example, sets, but also the morphisms, for example, functions. And so here I'm going to draw the tensor product on the morphisms, because it's a little more charismatic. So if I have a cobordism here and a cobordism here, I can tensor them, which just means sitting them side by side, so to speak, taking the disjoint union, and get a cobordism like that. And in this case, the unit object is the empty manifold, so nothing. If you sit nothing next to something, it looks just like something. So the point here is that in all these cases, this monoidal structure has to do with our ability to do processes sort of in parallel. So when you're like learning electric circuits, you learn about doing things in series and in parallel. And that's sort of what I'm talking about now. In electrical circuit theory, for some reason, they always stick in these extra little thingies like this. But you don't actually need to. So composition of morphisms is doing one process and then another, whereas this tensor product structure means doing two processes sort of side by side in a way that doesn't interfere at all. So in quantum mechanics, when we have two separate quantum systems and we want to think about the joint system, we just take the tensor product of the Hilbert spaces. Or if we have two quantum processes and we want to do them in parallel, we tensor product two operators between Hilbert spaces. Similarly, of course, in classical physics with sets, you have a set of states. And if you had a joint system, you take the Cartesian product of those sets to get the set of states for the joint system. So monoidal categories are an extra kind of feature that you can consider in category theory, which talks about the ability to do things in parallel. And there are a bunch of axioms that a monoidal category needs to satisfy that I don't feel like telling you those now. But here's what I want to tell you. There's this big difference. The tensor product in the category of sets is what we call Cartesian, whereas those in NCOB and Hilbert are not. So what does Cartesian mean? Well, basically it means that you can duplicate and delete data, meaning that for any object X in your category, there's a morphism, which I'll just call delta, going from X to X tensor X, which you think of as duplicating data, and also a morphism from X to the unit object, which you can think of as throwing out the data. And if you wanted to draw pictures of those morphisms in a kind of graphical way, you might think of them like this. This would be a kind of pictorial notation for this. So here, down here, I've drawn the unit for the tensor product, but I've drawn it so that it looks like nothing, which is what it actually is in the case of covertices. But I could write it there if I wanted. And you, to be Cartesian, it means that every object will have these, but they make a certain law hold, a pair of laws hold. And what do these laws say? Well, they say that going around this way is the same as going around this way. So doing nothing, i.e. the identity morphism, to something, is the same as duplicating it and then throwing out one and just keeping the one you've got. So if I drew that as a kind of diagrammatic, drew that in a diagrammatic style, which people have developed, so I could duplicate things here like this and then throw out the first copy and just let the second copy live, and that would be the same as just having not done anything at all. And then the other diagram there over on the right is just the mirror image version where you keep the other copy. So in the case of sets, you can do this. There's this function from any set to it cross itself, which takes any element and produces an ordered pair, where you, so to speak, duplicated that element. And you also have this function, this unique function, really, from any set to the one element set, which just takes anything and, well, there's not much choice. The one element set has just this one element, I'll call it star, and that's where it goes to. So you're basically throwing out all information about the element x, and it satisfies these laws. The famous fact about Hilbert spaces is that it's not monoidal. You can't duplicate a quantum state. You can't clone a quantum, as they say. But there's another side of that, which should be emphasized equally much. Perhaps it isn't emphasized quite as much, which is that you can't delete quantum information either without screwing something up. So the idea is, I think, that we're used to a metaphor of set theory as sort of the way the world should work, because when we're scribbling on pieces of paper, we feel like we have complete freedom to duplicate information and to delete it. And in fact, if you go to any copier room, you'll notice that right next to the Xerox machine, there's a wastebasket. And there's a reason for that. That's to make your category Cartesian. I mean, so I'm serious about that, actually. But they're sort of indispensable, deeply connected features, which of course any copying group should have. But if you believe in quantum mechanics, you know that you can't exactly duplicate that paper of yours. So if you duplicate it and then throw it into the wastebasket, make two copies, keep one of them, it's not the same as what you started with.
I was just going to ask, your morphisms on Hilbert space are linear operators?
Yeah, that's right.
But there are linear operators in Hilbert space and complex numbers, right?
There are lots of them, yes. There are many of them.
Is that not deleting?
There are many of them, but there are none that makes these diagrams work. That's right. So, right. So there are interesting differences there already, right? So already you see that in the case of sets, there's a unique function to the one-element set. In Hilbert spaces, there are lots of functions to the one-dimensional vector space that already should make you suspicious that which one would you pick out to be the method of deleting information. But in fact, my claim is that no matter which one you pick, you're not going to get this to work. Yeah?
It's just a dumb question. In Hilbert, what fails is that there is no unitary map that takes a Hilbert space to a cross itself.
No, I'm not imposing anything about unitarity here. I'm just, there are all sorts of things you can say. For finite dimensional ones, there's no unitary map that goes with you. Say, for infinite dimensional ones, there are. But what I'm saying is that there's no operator whatsoever, delta, together with an operator E, that makes these properties hold.
So, for example, it's the commutative diagrams of them.
Yeah, that's what puts a constraint on these. And these diagrams just say, if you duplicate something and throw out one copy, you're left with what you started with. And so I'm saying that fails. And my point also is that this property of having a tensor product but not having it be Cartesian is also true of MCOB. In other words, if you give me an arbitrary manifold, there's no way to find a cobordism from it, two copies of itself, and then a cobordism from one of those copies of itself down to the empty manifold, such that this whole manifold, which looks schematically sort of like this, is the same as the cylinder on that manifold, the manifold across the interval. So there too, it's not Cartesian. So we're seeing an interesting thing, and that space-times are acting more like quantum systems than sets are.
Are you going to show that by an example?
It's not so obvious. It's sort of a little non-obvious because the circle is one example where you actually can get it to work, right? So that's a non-proof, right? So for a circle, it does work. So that just lucks out, though. So all I'm saying is that if you took, you know, some arbitrary manifold, there's nothing like this. So you want me to find the simplest example? I don't feel like trying to find the simplest example right now. It's either we need to go up to either two or three manifolds to find the example.
Is this an intuition, like, you need to get kind of
defense? So you think of that torus or something, would you end up with a whole lost
torus? Oh, no, I have to think about it. Okay, so for two manifolds, it's actually true that you can always find some cobordism down to the empty two manifold. For three manifolds already, that's not true. The three manifolds, they're ones where you just can't find any way to get down to the empty set. There's a non-trivial cobordism group in that case. But for two manifolds, we can find that. We can think of this as just the solid torus. This stuff here is the solid torus, filling in the torus. And I guess, I don't know if this is an example or not. So you have to pick yourself something like that, and then you have to pick yourself a cobordism from the solid torus, sorry, from the pick a cobordism from the two-handled one to two copies, and I guess you get choices about how to do that, but there's a fairly obvious choice of a thing like this. And I may be claiming, I don't know if this is a counterexample or not, but I may be claiming that if you glue this stuff on like this, that that's not the same as just the identity cobordism. Now, I don't know if I have the intuition to tell right now if those are diffeomorphic or not. I sort of think they're not, but I have to think about it harder. But certainly when we get up to three manifolds, we can't even do this at all in general. There's not all three manifolds are cobordant to the empty set. Uh-oh, my computer's getting bored. I have to keep going. So eventually computers are going to be so advanced that they'll actually like really get bored. that's one way in which I'm claiming that MCOB is more like the set. Here's another. MCOB and Hild have duals for objects, but the category of sets does not. And I'll show you that, or I'll sketch that this is related to quantum teleportation and why it seems odd. So we say a monoidal category has duals if every object X has some other object, which I'll call X star, suggestively, together with morphisms from X star tensor X to the unit object, and from the unit to X tensor X star, which satisfy certain equations called the zigzag identities. So in the case of cobordisms, the zigzag identities look like zigzags. So in the case of cobordisms, S star is just the manifold S with its orientation reversed, and we get these E and I just by taking a cylinder and folding it over, either like this or upside down like that. And so you can think of that as like a universe and an anti-universe colliding and turning into nothing or something like that. Don't seriously, but it's perfect. But I didn't mark the physics. And the zigzag identities just say this, that if you stick those together with some identities as drawn here, that you get some cobordisms that are diffeomorphic to the identities. You can stretch out and pull it straight. In the category of Hilbert spaces, you also have duals, and there the dual is just the dual Hilbert space. So if you have a Hilbert space and it's dual, a guy in here and a guy in here can get mapped to a number So that's just applying a linear functional L to a state psi to get a complex number. And you also have this map going the other way. You can think of H tensor H star as the space of operators on H, trace class operators. Yeah. This is for finite dimensional ones, this works, by the way. Where, and this map just sends any complex number to that complex number times the identity. And then if you work it out of the zigzag identity, say, which I urge you to do, you see, this is some familiar stuff about linear algebra. But the point is that the category of sets does not have any concept like this. So there's nothing which acts like a dual of a set. And you can try to dream something up, but it just can't. And so that's another way, you see, in which, and cobordisms are more like linear algebra than they are like set theory. So that space-time is more like quantum mechanics than set theory. And the point of this for quantum mechanics in particular is that Sam Abramsky and Bob Kuka have shown that they've given a very nice category theoretic study of quantum mechanics. This paper here, which is on my website for this talk, I'll link to it. And they've shown that quantum teleportation, if you boil it down to its essence, one of the key aspects of it is that you're using this zigzag axiom. So what they're trying to do is try to find the basic structures of category theory that allow you to do various things that we're used to in quantum mechanics. And in quantum teleportation, you can think of it this way. A particle comes in. It interacts with one of a pair of particles that's been prepared in the Bell state. And this thing here actually does wind up producing you a pair of particles in the Bell state if, instead of thinking of cobordisms, we're thinking about Hilbert spaces, and we're going into H tensor H star, where H is the Hilbert space of states for a spin one-half particle. And so it interacts with one, and then magically, quote unquote, its quantum state gets transferred to the other member of the pair. So in a naive sense, it's sort of it's coming in here, it interacts with one of these guys. We do a measurement, and then we look at what happened, what comes out at the end here, the other state, and that turns out to have the same quantum state that you started with initially. So that as an operator, you get this. Now, there's some subtleties here in understanding how this picture here gives you the actual details of quantum teleportation. And I don't want to go into those, but this paper really works it through in detail. So it's not just sort of a vague metaphor. It's a mathematically precise correspondence.
Suppose the evolution is non-unitary. Then how would this zigzag diagram look like?
The zigzag diagram just looks like what it looks like. I mean, so that's what it looks like. This operator here is not unitary. That's the most important thing, is that these operators here cannot be unitary. So the reason why I'm saying, there's some details I'm not telling you, is that when you're doing quantum teleportation, the overall dynamics of your whole system has to be unitary. So it's not as if you're only doing this. You have to be doing some other stuff too. And the other type of stuff you're doing, for example, is you're measuring something about these guys. And of course, over at this end, you're doing some process that actually prepares them. So this is sort of like a piece of the bigger picture.
In what sense does this help me understand the weirdness of quantum mechanics? So I've mapped Hilbert spaces to n-cob, but space in which the locality or non-locality problem arises is not to the n-cob space that you have there.
Well, I don't know exactly how to answer the question that way. What I'm trying to say is that you do this complicated, mysterious mathematics. You say, look, quantum teleportation is possible, but it seems awfully weird. And then you notice that in some other context, that same mathematics shows up. And what that mathematics says is if you have a wiggly strand of spaghetti, if you stretch it, it becomes straight, which seems a lot less surprising. And so I don't completely know what that means. But I suggest that that's a good thing to look at. If you can take something counterintuitive and say, it's just like this other thing that seems pathetically simple.
But it seems that your witness is there. You quantum mechanics being a tensor category and space in which Gibbs is a set category. So
well,
they don't go together very well.
Well, I'm trying to say that quantum mechanics, that we'll only really understand quantum mechanics really well when we completely combine it with the theory of space-time. So it's not been combined yet, so it's still supposed to seem weird. I'm not trying to... So this is a, yeah, this is a somewhat preliminary business. In other words, I claim we're getting lots of clues that quantum mechanics is like space-time. And I'm not completely sure what to do with these clues, but I want to say what people have done with these clues. So my point here is that quantum theory seems counterintuitive if you go ahead and expect Hilbert to act just like set, because it doesn't. So even though Hilbert spaces and operators are sets and functions with some extra structure, that's not how they act. If you think of them structurally, what they're much more like is spaces and spacetimes. And I claim that this is a clue. I'm not completely sure what the clue is trying to tell us. But I do want to emphasize that this clue is not new. It's been around for a while. It's been known for a while. And maybe Feynman was the first one to notice it, because he started drawing these diagrams that have a very geometrical or topological character. But what they are is they're diagrams that describe operators between Hilbert spaces. And he was able to understand a lot of things about quantum field theory that way, that were denied to people like Bohr, who said, that can't be right. We know that quantum mechanics doesn't allow particles to trace out specific trajectories. So at Shelter Island, Feynman was like angrily trying to explain that he's not saying that this is an actual track in space-time. It's just some kind of metaphor, but it's an extremely powerful metaphor. Now we understand the mathematics of Feynman diagrams quite a bit better in the sense of putting them in a very nice general framework. And this framework is just what I'm talking about. It's this relationship between, well, it's this fact that Hilbert spaces form a monoidal category with certain properties that allow you to manipulate operators as if they were pictures like this. But in a sense, it was really Penrose with his spin networks that took this to the point of actually trying to build space-time out of pictures like this, which are, again, just metaphors for quantum processes. So nowadays, we know that Feynman diagrams are just about a certain monoidal category, say the category of representations of the Poincaré group. Spin networks are the same thing, but with a different group, SU2. And so they fit into a common category theoretic framework. Of course, these people didn't need to know the category theory to invent that. But for us people who aren't geniuses, it's nice to have a framework that we can work in. And I claim that both string theory and spin foam models are trying to exploit this clue. So what they're groping towards is some kind of language for quantum space-time where the distinction between a geometry and quantum processes gets blurred. So that you can draw a picture like this, and it stands for an operator or something like that. And I claim that we're just sort of groping around trying to understand the correct mathematical vocabulary for this. And so that's why we shouldn't really hope that any of these things are getting predictive theories right now. We're just sort of seeing a few things here and there. Now I want to say a little bit about two categories and how they get into the game. So since strings and spin foams are both two-dimensional souped-up versions of Feynman diagrams, once you know about two categories, you'll see that that means that you should use two categories to describe the different ways you can stick them together. So what's a two category? Well, I'll only tell you what a strict one is, because we're getting in a rush here. So it's a slightly category, but it's a little fancier. So it has objects, morphisms, but now also two morphisms, like this. You may object to the fact that both F and G have to start at the same point and end at the same point. You might prefer working with a little thing that looks like a square, but it turns out that you can do that too using two-category theory. It's just that this type of picture is taken as primitive, and then you can build up all sorts of more fancy pictures. And what you can do is you can compose morphisms just like you could before, but you can compose the two morphisms in two different ways, vertically and horizontally. And all these laws are associative, and they all have identities. And finally, there's one extra law, which says that if you take this picture, it gives you something well-defined. In other words, if I have two morphisms stuck together this way, in other words, having appropriate sources and targets, I could think of it different ways. I could think, oh, I'm going to vertically compose these, and then horizontally compose those. Or you could say, no, I'm going to horizontally compose these two top ones, horizontally compose the bottom ones, and then vertically compose the result. And the law that I'm sketching here says that we get the same answer both ways. So what that law lets us do, in fact, it turns out, is to write down diagrams where we have a whole bunch of polygons stuck together, and those polygons are labeled in a way that makes them be specific two morphisms. And sticking them together, we get another two morphism that will be well-defined. So in other words, no matter how you analyze that picture into subpictures, you get the same answer. So it's the math of sticking together two-dimensional things. And I've so far have found it showing up in physics in four different ways that are probably all related. So in string theory, or actually in any conformal field theory, there's a two-category lurking around where the objects are D-brains. The morphisms are states of strings going from one D-brain to another. And the two morphisms are time evolution operators taking string states to string states, which you can think of as coming from world sheets. So again, here you might prefer to draw a little square picture where you imagine that the D brains are sort of sitting there as time passes and it's being, say, whittling around with its head stuck in these two D brains. So this categorical look at string theory has been really developed quite beautifully by some German authors, Wolf, Fuchs, and Schweiger. And I have on my webpage some links to that. So it's a very elaborate, beautiful story, which I don't have time for. But it shows that this is really a sensible outlook. And in particular, the way the D brains fit into the rest of the structure is mathematically perfectly natural. Nothing stuck in. In 3D quantum gravity, two categories show up. And more generally, in any extended TQFT, so there we've got a two-category where some of this is very new. Objects describe different kinds of matter, you could say particles, perhaps. Morphisms describe different choices of space, and two morphisms describe different choices of space-time. So the first place this has been seen is in the case of 3D quantum gravity, where first people thought of 3D quantum gravity as something that would give you a Hilbert space of states for any surface, so space could look like this, and an operator for any space-time, i.e. any cobordism. So you can imagine a cobordism like this. And that's fine, but more recently people have realized that it also is good to think about space being itself a manifold with boundaries, i.e., for example, a surface with some little disks cut out. And then those disks will actually act like particles. So in other words, you can think of more general processes where things like this go on. You can calculate, using just 3D quantum gravity, you can calculate amplitudes for processes like this. Recover Feynman rules in the limit as g goes to zero. So we're getting a wonderful story showing up, thanks to Laurent and David Lopre, Edward Levine, people. And so what's mathematically going on here is we've got this two category where the objects are collections of circles, the morphisms are cobordisms between those, i.e. surfaces with a bunch of disks cut out, and then the two morphisms are things going between those, maybe free manifolds going between those, so like the birth of a something like that. So in fact, this cobordism picture naturally leads to these higher levels of morphisms like that. The same thing is turning out in 4D Biot theory, in particular topological gravity, but there, instead of little punctures getting, I didn't do that. Where's the computer wizard?
It's not me.
Now the whole this is different. Now it's the whole system is tired of my talk.
I think there must have been a power glitch.
There was a thunder.
I will try.
Just wake up.
Wake up! No, the computer's not asleep. Yeah, it's not the computer that's. It has its own power source. It's.
Are you going to talk? Are you able to be going on the board, or are
you? Yeah, I can talk. Yeah. Okay. Okay, reduce one notch of technology. Back to limestone on slate. So that never breaks for some reason. So somehow we got a little something happening here. Trouble is, this is always much more exciting than the talk. So even if I talk, you're going to be much more interested in what he's doing. Even I'm not. It just suddenly went blue. There was apparently like a little power blip.
Yeah, there was.
Yeah. So maybe, I think it's this thing. Because my computer has its own battery, so it's still happy. Should I try to talk? I'm seeing Lee, actually. You think it's what he listened to?
We're all very interested because this could happen to anyone.
Yeah, well. It did happen to me. So I've avoided doing computer talks for many years. So this is the first time when it's actually done what I've always known it would do, which is to suddenly do something mysterious. Yay! Okay. Oh, yay! Okay. Okay, we're winning. Okay, great. So the same sort of thing happens in 4D topological gravity, but there, instead of poking out little disks from a 2-manifold, it turns out you can poke out little tori from a 3-manifold, and they act like strings of a certain sort. It's a kind of topological string theory, certainly not like a Polyakov action type string theory. But anyway, the point of this is that in addition to just space and space-time, which is what I was talking about at the category theoretic level, we're getting matter coming in at this two-category theoretic framework. So that was very exciting to me when that started happening. I've been working on something called higher gauge theory, which is a generalization of gauge theory that uses two categories. So there the idea is we have fields that let you describe parallel transport, not just for point particles moving along paths, as in ordinary gauge theory, but also for strings, or basically just curves, tracing out surfaces. You don't need the whole mechanics of string theory to do this, but it does apply to string theory. I've worked on this in a bunch of papers with Toby Barrels, Alyssa Kranz, Aaron Lauda, who are students of mine, Urs Schreiber, who's in Germany, working with those other Germans, actually, in my categories in physics, and Danny Stevens, who's at UCR now. And the idea is that if you have any manifold, it gives you a two-category, where the objects are the points in it, the morphisms are the paths in it, and the two morphisms are surfaces mapped into it, shaped like in the picture there. So in other words, what we're doing here is we're taking these pictures of two categories really literally. And the idea is that two category is the two category that's all about parallel transport along paths, and now surfaces as well. Now, ordinary gauge theory, you pick a gauge group. And a gauge group, well, a group is just a special category that has one object, and all the morphisms go from it to itself, and they're all invertible. So it's about symmetries of something. In higher gauge theory, it turns out that you can generalize that and then use two groups, which are just two categories with one object and with everything invertible. And I've been working out the classification of two groups. And it turns out that when you work it all out, you see, sort of a pun, that a two-group consists of two groups with some extra operations related, which I won't list for you. But there's a group G and a group H. And when you set up this higher gauge theory, the appropriate notion of a connection turns out to consist of a Lie algebra of G-valued one form, just like in ordinary gauge theory, but also a Lie algebra of H-valued two form. And the idea is you'd like to get parallel transport along paths to give you elements of that group G, and parallel transport along surfaces to give you elements of H. And it works out very beautifully if the A and B fields satisfy a certain equation. It turns out they need to satisfy an equation to make the parallel transport along the surfaces be invariant under reparameter. Let's see. Don't tell it. So, we're really in trouble. I better finish quick. Things are, I feel building shapes. Oh, that's what it is. Oh, thunderstorms.
Finish the talk before it's too late.
Right, we're going up to a climax here. We're going to end with a big lightning bolt. So God doesn't like two category things. So it held me back for a couple of years, the fact that these fields need to satisfy an equation to get everything to work. So I just didn't expect that it should go like that. It's getting brighter. But it turns out that equation is something that shows up in a theory called BF theory. And the equation basically just says that B is proportional to F, the curvature of A. This is the equation that you get in BF theory in four-dimensional spacetime. So it turns out that this I had this other mention of how strings of a sort showed up in 4D topological gravity, but here again we're getting something nice, that namely you can define consistent parallel transport for particles and strings in this theory. And we used a lot of this two category stuff to get that done. Last example of how two categories show up in physics is the example of spin foams. So Feynman diagrams, really, if you think about them long enough, you see that they're just a way of reasoning diagrammatically with morphisms in Hill, i.e. with operators. So like if you have an operator from H tensor H to H, you can draw it as a Feynman diagram with this picture in the middle here. And typically, we might label the edges with indices that run over a basis of the Hilbert space. Of course, in traditional Feynman diagrams, that basis would be called the momentum and spin states of the particles. And then when you stick together Feynman diagrams to compose these processes, you sum over those labels on the intermediate edges. But if you think about it, you see that that's really just the same thing as writing a tensor with the indices for the inputs and the outputs. And that when we're summing or integrating over these labels, what we're doing is just the usual Einstein summation convention. So Feynman diagrams are really just a pictorial way of keeping track of the summation convention. They just happen to have been developed at first in the case of representations of the Poincaré group instead of finite dimensional tensors. But it was Penrose who realized that you could do this type of notation for plain old tensors. And so the mathematics of categories have been developed to completely sort of formalize these ways that you can stick together pictures like this. But now when we go up to two categories, it turns out that you can do the same kind of thing, but instead of sort of basically one-dimensional kind of things, graphs, you get two-dimensional kinds of things, which I've called spin foams. And they are two morphisms now in a certain two category of gizmos called two Hilbert spaces, which are in fact a kind of categorified version of the Hilbert space. And the point is that you can think of this as a geometrical entity. This is just an example here. It doesn't mean much. But you can think of it also as just kind of abstract index notation that's been sort of made more attractive by drawing it pictorially. And when you stick together these kind of things, you need to sum over the indices. But now there are two flavors of indices. There are indices that label faces, and then there are also indices that label edges. I know that these indices here are too small to see, but that's sort of the point. As a mathematician, the indices are always too small for me to see. I think of them as sort of like flies that gather around interesting equations, and I just sort of want to brush them off and get to what the real interesting stuff is. And so this is sort of a way of doing that. Namely, you can erase the indices here or here, and you'd still know enough to be able to do what you want to do, namely stick together these pictures in various ways and write down this identity. This particular guy here is called the 6J symbol. So it's a two-morphism going from this process on top to this process on bottom here. And it's this particular guy that's the building block of the 3D quantum gravity. In other words, you take your three-dimensional manifold and you imagine things like this in it, and you stick them together to compute an amplitude. So the two categories are showing up naturally when we have two-dimensional physics, or two-dimensional physics embedded in higher-dimensional space. And I claim that what that is it's another step towards building this language which will let us unify our way of thinking about space-time and our way of thinking about quantum theory. And so that's what I wanted to tell you about, just to give you a taste of that. So I'll stop here.
Thank you for the very dramatic.
Yes, thanks. I do that for all people.
Right. Now we can tell them that was all set up.
Yeah, that's right. It was just.
We have guys on the roof.
Turn the switches on and off.
Okay.
Yes.
It is logically possible that quantum theory actually breaks down the other part of scale. So then you have all compromise in some way. So
or what?
Compromise in some serious way. So do you have, can you accommodate that kind of contingency?
I could, but I don't really want to. So it's just not my interest in making
it possible.
Well, it's certainly possible, so in the sense that higher category theory is a very general language for sticking together higher dimensional shapes. So you don't have to buy into quantum mechanics to use it any more than you'd have to like buy into quantum mechanics to use set theory or something. It's just my own particular interest that I'm trying to push here is to show how higher category theory lets you find a common framework for the algebra of quantum mechanics and the topology that shows up in a lot of physical theories. So that's what I like to do.
So how would you describe the measurement process of a quantum theory from your category theory? Is it possible?
I don't have anything interesting to say about that. So in other words, I'm just a humdrum sort of physicist who, humdrum mathematical physicist who knows all about operators, how to tensor them, and so on. And if you ask me my opinions about the measurement problem, I require a few beers before I say anything about that. So I'm not trying to shed any light on that problem here. I am saying, though, that people who are trying to understand the puzzles of quantum mechanics should think about this a bit because of all the way mysterious things in quantum mechanics map onto non-mysterious things about topology. But I mean, we all have our own axe to grind as far as the measurement problem goes, and so I don't know if it'll help you with your axe. I don't know if it'll help you grind your axe.
Processes may have, I think what you call it, what is it called? Processes are not title and another.
Tensoring is the math word. Yeah.
And that sort of feels like it's sort of putting things alongside each other in time, that would be the competition.
Oh,
yeah, putting things alongside each other in space.
Right.
And if you look at the main approaches to quantum gravity, they both are, in some sense, sort of seem to fall on there because the quantum loop approach is a 3+1 approach. So freezes in a particular way of thinking about separating space and time. And then string theory has a fixed background so that you can say carefully what time is and what space is. And yet, probably in quantum gravity, you expect the space and time will have to get messed up in some way. So isn't there a danger in this kind of approach that you're actually freezing in exactly the features of present theories that we want to get rid of, namely this partitioning between space and time?
There certainly is the danger. I guess the good news is that you can investigate that danger in the specific context of, for example, 2 plus 1 quantum gravity, which is certainly not rich enough to study everything. But it is, I think, enough to study this aspect. So in other words, you can study Lorentzian 2 plus 1 quantum gravity, where you're using this approach. And it works in the sense that you can recover the things that everyone agrees about for 2 plus 1 quantum gravity. And then you can ponder the question. And then I don't know if anyone has done this, Craigona. Are you doing any injustice to the theory by working intensively with Hilbert spaces of states associated to two metaphors, which you think of as spaces of states on some space-like surface? Of course, you're not picking a particular slice when you're doing that. You're just saying, here's some slice, I give you a state on it, and then you give me some other slice at some other time and some proportion zone between them, I'll compute an operator for you that way. So I don't actually see anything that's really bad. But it is certainly using this idea of a slice. I don't think that's bad as long as you get to change your mind about which slice, how you can slice it.
Hi, are light cones themselves as surfaces constructed past the space-time examples of two morphisms? And can you use that kind of a example to build in the notion of causality into the processes of vortices?
I don't know about that. Yes, I think it's really interesting to try to build ideas of causality more to this type of framework. So this framework was sort of first developed, well, for example, what I mean by this framework. This framework where you're describing field theories, for example, topological field theories, using higher categories. So it was first developed and studied for situations where space-time was treated as Riemann or Euclidean. So there was no notion of light cone or causality into it. Then it turns out that it seems to work, except for more mathematical subtleties having to do with potential divergences and so on. It seems to work in the Lorentzian case, but it doesn't talk about light cones or null arrays or things like that. And it doesn't talk about, for example, a causal order on events. And I think that would be a really interesting thing to think of. You know, I've thought about it a bit, but I haven't made any progress.
Well, I mean, there is something to say along those lines. If you consider a fishy, where the base category is the order of events, then you can do some things. It's
right.
It would be in a somewhat different form of that, but it's basically still categorical.
Yeah. So.
I don't know.
Yeah. So there's that. I would like to somehow combine it more with this in some nice way, not slapping things together either. But, you know, really seeing how causality fits into this game. Yeah, that's probably one of the big missing pieces.
I just have a simple question. You started by talking about cloning and deleting as being characterized the difference between the category of states and the other two categories. In quantum mechanics, though, you have, it's not just that you have no cloning, it's that you have some restriction on cloning. You can't clone non-orthogonal states. Is there some way in this framework to represent the fact that you can clone orthogonal sets of states, but you can't clone, an set of states?
I'll just say yes. I don't have anything incredibly intelligent to say about that. One thing that you're using there is you're using a kind of extra feature, which is this idea of an orthonormal basis. And the idea of an orthonormal basis is really related to the fact that there are these pair of functors, ways of going back and forth between sets and Hilbert spaces. We're given a set, we can build a Hilbert space that has that as its set of orthonormal, as an orthonormal basis. And then this is a different thing. This is just you take your Hilbert space and you look at the underlying set. So every Hilbert space is a set. So these are, I hope I've got it right, at least in the finite dimensional case, these are examples of what you call adjoint functors. And so what you're doing when you're starting to talk about several categories in one breath is you're talking about relationships between, say, different contexts. So you might roughly, vaguely think of this as like a quantum world, this is the classical world. And so the fact that you can duplicate successfully on an orthonormal basis, I think it's what it's doing is it's using the fact that this guy is Cartesian. And so, yeah, I think there is something you can say about that. Yep.
Yes, so I'm wondering if you could elaborate a bit on to what extent you're supposed to think of the Cartesian and Cobb category as the space-time in some way, which you seem to be implying.
No, I'm not really trying to imply that.
So then,
I'm using MCOB as a simple stand-in for a whole bunch of different categories that have a sort of topological flavor to them. So, I mean, if you really thought that MCOB was the right framework if you're talking about space-time, then you're saying space-time is a manifold. And I don't necessarily want to buy into that. I would like to allow myself to think about a whole bunch of different categories, and more generally n categories, where in addition to being a manifold, it could be something like this, it could be a piecewise linear complex, it could be labeled in certain ways. There's a whole bunch of categories that have the same general property.
But you might relax a manifold properties, but it looks like the tensor category structure of n-hole has to do with the fact that it's the topology that matters. So at some level, you want geometry to matter. And do you think that you could? Is there such a notion as going to...
There are. That's going to what? Putting geometry in? I mean, I can certainly make up, for example, a category where the morphisms are like this, but in addition, these spaces have labels, which could say their area. I can make up a category where the morphisms look like this, but they were equipped with Lorentzian metrics, and you need to require that things to match in a nice way when you stick them together. So a lot of the general features of all those categories will be the same. In particular, all of them will have a monoidal structure where you can just set two things side by side as the tensor product. They'll differ in various ways, of course, too. So I'm not trying to play favorites among those right now. I'm trying to point out that all of those have a bunch of common properties, which are, for example, having this non-Cartesian monoidal structure. And it's just interesting that all those different guys have these properties, which are also properties that Hilbert spaces and operators have. So I'm just trying to get at a very general point here by means of that example. And so you could try to look at things like this where there's what's called partial order vertices, if you wanted to put causality in. But I would hope that I could just do more than sort of slap it on top of what I already have. I'd like to, because causality is itself a very category theoretic concept. It's about partial ordered sets. So I'd like to really work it in there somehow, but I just don't know.
Okay, there were some more hands before.
Yes, anybody? And then we'll see. It's getting hot.
Okay, so I have a last question. Uh-huh. Can you give us an example of the two things?
Sure. So I've been working with Laurent and Aristide on something called the Poincaré G-group, and we're using it for some physics. So it's so it'll have a group of objects, which will be Lorentz group. And then every one of those objects will have a bunch of morphisms from it to itself, which will be all the translations. So it's the way, so it turns out whenever you have a semi-direct product of groups, like the Pontryagin group, there's a way to sort of bust it apart and make it into a two-group where they occupy different layers. And it turns out that those sort of two groups, those semi-direct product ones, they actually show up in BF theory. So in other words, BF theory, you can think of as a theory in four dimensions. You can think of it as a connection, theory of a connection for two group, for the two group is of the semi-direct product. Yeah. I have a big fat paper on two groups where I list lots of examples of them. So they're not some kind of completely nebulous thing. You can start classifying them, find really geometrically interesting examples of them.
Well, time is here until the 20th, so we'll have some time to discuss with him. Thank you very much.
Sure, thanks.